as an enormous potential market.
There was a real euphoria about Iraq as the next powerhouse in the region and a place with unlimited amounts of money that could become an important American partner.
And customer.
So President Bush didn't send any stiff warning to Saddam. In fact, American diplomats made it seem as if the United States would not even react militarily. 8 days before the invasion, Saddam asked to meet with American Ambassador April Glaspie. She assured him that the United States would take no position in the event of any border conflict between Iraq and Kuwait. She left, announcing she was going on vacation.
Saddam Hussein feels completely reassured. There you have an ambassadress who leaves for vacation the 26th or the 27th of July, while he had fixed the date for the invasion, August 1st. And particularly that declaration, we won't get mixed up in anything.
2 days later, what Glaspie said was repeated in public hearings by a much higher U.S. official, John Kelly, Assistant Secretary of State. Congressman Lee Hamilton repeatedly asked Kelly how the U.S. would respond if Saddam attacked Kuwait.
I recall asking him about treaty commitments, and the Secretary said there were no treaty commitments involved here.
So if you were Saddam Hussein listening to that, what would your...
We did not draw, it seems to me, a firm line in the sand. We did not convey strongly and clearly that we would react militarily if he went across that border.
A few days later, Saddam invaded Kuwait. Later, when the United States was mobilizing hundreds of thousands of soldiers to repulse that invasion, another American congressman, Tom Lantos, delivered an even more devastating critique of John Kelly and the U.S. government for having so long refused to recognize the true nature of Saddam.
This obsequious treatment of him by a large variety of high-ranking officials encouraged him to take this action, and there is no way of escaping that responsibility.
As the U.S. and its coalition allies prepared to do battle against Saddam, they confronted another awful irony. In many ways, they were taking on an enemy they and their arms dealers had done so much to create. And that brought some peculiar problems. For years, for instance, as part of the deal to sell Mirage fighter planes to Saddam, France also agreed to train Saddam's pilots in France.
When the war broke out with Iraq over Kuwait, I realized that there were still pilots who were being trained in France on the planes that we had sold them, which meant that suddenly we found ourselves in a state of war with Iraq, and we had Iraqi pilots in France.
But even more embarrassing for the French, their crack French fighter pilots were unable to show off their sophisticated Mirage in the fight against Saddam. Why? Because they were exactly the same planes they'd sold to the Iraqis.
Although the French were fairly precluded from participating in a lot of the offensive air campaign, we were very concerned that our pilots would not be able to distinguish between a French-operated Mirage and an Iraqi-operated Mirage, so we were worried about fratricide.
An even bigger quandary for the U.S. and its allies was the extremely effective defense radar system that the French firm Thompson had sold to Saddam for hundreds of millions of dollars. It incorporated all the newest technologies.
The French were able to build a system that integrated all of this into a coordinated air defense system that was quite sophisticated. I mean, it was a very, very difficult system to attack.
So what was done?
Well, because the French were part of the coalition, they were able to provide us a lot of information on the system, where the critical nodes were, and we were able to attack it quite successfully.
So the French in the end gave...
The French in the end took down their own system, basically.
Of course, the amount of aid the Americans had given Saddam over the years would also present some curious problems, some that continue to this day. For instance, we found that some of Saddam's elite forces were brought to the United States in the 80s, to be given specialized training by the famed American Green Berets.
We were training through the Green Berets, we were training counterinsurgency training, because we were afraid that if Iran overwhelmed Saddam's army that the units might have to go underground and operate underground. And so they received training in being able to operate as guerrillas themselves on their home turf. You can imagine now, as we look back on that effort to train them, the consequences with our own troops now facing the Iraqis who got that training from the United States.
In 1991, with the U.S. and its allies now out to destroy the military machine they'd done so much to create, the Gulf War became a showcase of the most sophisticated Western technology, a huge, bloody video game. Saddam's forces are driven out of Kuwait, but Saddam's defeat only sets the stage for an even more ghastly tragedy. These mass graves are evidence of the most massive atrocity of which Saddam is accused, the slaughter of 300,000 Shiites, their remains only now being uncovered. They rose up against the dictator in 1991 after Saddam's defeat in Kuwait and were horrifically repressed. A crime denounced around the globe, but once again, the United States and its allies were complicit in those killings.
The United States had total responsibility for those uprisings. By militarily smashing Saddam Hussein, it created the possibility for the uprisings. And second, the first President Bush on the 15th of February twice called for the Iraqi people to rise up against Saddam Hussein.
That call came with the United States still battling Iraqi forces.
The world will not allow.
President Bush suggested a way to end the conflict, a massive popular revolt.
There's another way for the bloodshed to stop, and that is for the Iraqi military and the Iraqi people to take matters into their own hands, to force Saddam Hussein, the dictator, to step aside.
The president's call was repeatedly broadcast all over Iraq.
The same message over and over again about, rise up. It's your time to do that. It's your duty to get rid of Saddam and his regime.
Zainab is a Shiite from the southern city of Karbala, one of thousands who joined the uprising.
I felt this is my fight. I was only 20 years old, coming out of high school. And there is no hope, there is no future inside Iraq. So it was, for me, it was, I have to fight for my freedom.
The uprising was spontaneous, unplanned, and it swept across southern Iraq like wildfire. Many of Saddam's soldiers joined the revolt.
It was a great victory. We felt just so great. There was a hope that they will get rid of Saddam, it will be over, and they will build a new Iraq.
Meanwhile, in the north of Iraq, the country's Kurds also launched an uprising.
In a few weeks, it had taken over all of Kurdistan, and so there was this enormous sense of euphoria. For the first time, the Kurds were controlling their own destiny.
But tragedy was building. Once the U.S. had expelled Saddam from Kuwait, it turned out that George Bush, despite his calls for an uprising, had no serious plans for Iraq at all.
As a result,
at the time, Thomas Pickering was high up in the U.S. government, ambassador to the United Nations.
We had wonderfully prepared combat activities, and we had absolutely no idea about what to do in a post-combat phase.
And there was no policy.
No policy, no real settled interests, no examination of what we should do, no examination of how we should deal with the future, except that we didn't want to go to Baghdad.
Deploying hundreds of thousands of troops without any idea what you're going to do?
Yep. Fairly convincingly so.
How could that have happened?
Well, it happened 13 years later. Why ask the question about 1991?
Same thing now.
Yeah.
So back in 1991, when the peace treaty was signed, the Americans forbid the Iraqis from flying their planes, but allowed them to keep using their helicopters. Helicopters which the Iraqis then used with deadly effect against the uprising.
Let them
That's what we heard on the streets of Baghdad when we met survivors of the uprising. They were protesting against the return of Saddam's Ba'ath Party to power. They said they'd been decimated by those helicopters.
I saw the planes turning in the sky as Saddam's helicopters bombarded us. The Americans protected them. It was like an American cover. Without Saddam's air force, the regime would have fallen. He was finished in 1991.
We wanted the freedom. 3/4 of the cities are liberated and not under the control of Saddam. He's in his weakest point. We need to be liberated and we need help.
What help?
Help that America promised to give to Iraqis.
When did they promise to give help?
Well, that was through the radio and what we heard in the radio.
And that is for the Iraqi military and the Iraqi people to take matters into their own hands and force Saddam Hussein to step aside.
If you listen to what Bush said, he never explicitly said, we will give you help.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what was understood among the people.
How do you explain then these calls for an uprising on the part of the United States?
All of the efforts to debilitate Saddam and to create problems for him in order to remove him from Kuwait were justified.
Even though the U.S. couldn't follow up afterwards to help these people who rose up?
In war and love, all's fair.
Having called for the uprising, the Bush administration then decided it didn't want it to succeed.
We are not in the process now of assisting through provisioning arms to these groups that are in uprising against the current government. We don't want to see a power vacuum develop in Iraq. We want to see the territorial integrity of Iraq preserved. So do all of the other coalition partners.
Every president I have known has described the U.S. interests in the Gulf as a vital interest. Presidents do not use the word vital casually. Vital means vital. And it means that if we don't have access to that oil, it affects the vital interests of the United States. We're in trouble immediately.
That's the bottom line.
That's the bottom line. There's no question about it.
The Americans wanted that Saddam Hussein be replaced, but by them, in order to control the country. What good is it to have made a war if you leave the power with people that you don't know?
That was the decision of French leaders as well.
So for France and U.S., it was important that Saddam stays in power.
That could be one of the considerations which explains why the Americans said, after all, there's someone who holds on to this country. Let's see how he does. He helped them with very brutal methods that we would not tolerate, but it was, I would say, realpolitik.
To find an American witness to the human result of that realpolitik, we went to southern Arizona and spoke with Rocky Gonzalez, a veteran of U.S. Special Forces. In 1991, he was stationed in southern Iraq.
People started showing up at our perimeter with chemical burns. Burns on their face, their hands, places where our skin was exposed. They were coming to us in streams saying that we were fighting the Iraqi military and the Ba'ath Party, and they sprayed us with chemicals.
And these people, what did they want?
They wanted aid. They wanted to be treated. They wanted to be protected. And some of the individuals who were armed wanted us to give them weapons and ammunition so they could go fight.
What did you ask of to the Americans?
We asked them for military help and food because we had neither arms nor food nor water. Their reply was to give nothing. They said it was the orders that they had received from the Pentagon.
We were under orders not to assist or to aid in any way, so we could not.
Had they been given any encouragement from the U.S.?
There were pamphlets that were dropped by the psychological operation units, and those leaflets told them to rise up and fight the regime and free themselves. One individual carried it and he was waving it at us.